Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire Investigates, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private eye and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on the top of the game at the top of the crime. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. You can also join our live chat or email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. If you're a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death, or if you'd like the CrimeWire team to consider you for a future case in the future, please email us again at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
How you doing, Susan? We got a great show tonight.
We do. You know, as we do, we're going to start doing every week, we're going to highlight an unsolved murder case. And in light of the Drew Peterson murder trial that's coming up, there's a case out in Illinois, in Plainfield, that back in 2007 of April, just months before Stacey Peterson went missing, Lisa Stevick, who was going through a divorce with her husband, two small boys, and she just vanished one day on April 30th at 6 o'clock in the afternoon or the early evening. Her car was left there. They have never been able to see activity on her cell phone. They've never been able, police, to see activity on her credit cards. She just vanished. The family is offering a $75,000 reward for any information leading up to the rest of the person responsible. And you all know what I think about who I think is responsible. According to police, Lisa was 37 at the time that she disappeared in 2007. Again, she's 5'2", tall, 120 pounds, brown hair, brown eyes. She has two visible tattoos, a small rose on her ankle and a large butterfly on her lower back. The tip line number, and this is very important because somebody must have seen something. Although, because I'm from Illinois, Plainfield is a very unique area. You've got a town with a lot of desolate space, woods, and if you see something, even while you're, you know, recently in Florida, I remember reading last week that a man had stopped to relieve himself. He found bones, and they haven't identified them someplace in Florida, just by stopping off someplace. So if you see anything, you hear anything, you know anything, the number is 815-267-7217. That's Lisa Stevick. And the website is findlisa@gmail.com. And again, this case received a lot of press right after Stacey Peterson went missing, Vito, and it's a shame that it's kind of fallen off the radar.
Well, you know what we got here? It's amazing. I was just thinking about it as you're talking, Susan. We got Illinois, where it seems we're getting a lot of these things with missing women, missing wives, murders of wives. You got Florida, where it seems like the child abductions and the predators roam like crazy. And this Oklahoma case that we're going to go into is just total chaos out there. I mean, you know, I was just out there about 6-8 weeks ago. My daughter and her family live in the Tulsa, Broken Arrow area. And, you know, I learned a lot being out there, let me just say, as far as connections and the tightness of people together. So, you know, and then reading this case, spending the time before our show reading about this case, it's absolutely amazing. And I think what we're going to do, are you done with that part, Susan?
Yes, sir, I am.
First part? All right. Let's go into what's called the Tom Horton case. The CrimeWire team continues our special investigation with the medical examiner's office in Oklahoma. This week, we are discussing the murder in 2008 of Tom Horton in Oklahoma. This case is the second of the three medical examiner cases in our investigation series. which is a shame that we have to include medical examiners as the one of the prime sources of why we're talking about these, but it is what it is. Joining us for this segment, I think, from CitizensAgainstHomicide.org, Inc., is CrimeWire consultant Gene Cervantes. Is he there?
I think he's coming on right after.
He's coming on next, Vito.
Okay, no problem. On December the 10th, 2008, Tom Horton was found dead. Tom Horton's death was ruled by the Oklahoma Medical Examiner's Office as a suicide. Family members alleged otherwise. Since the death of Tom Horton, they have been petitioning to have this case reopened. Through their own investigation, the person responsible attempted to conceal the crime by altering aspects of the crime scene, destroying physical evidence, and forging a suicide note. The family alleges that this homicide was subsequently overlooked, actively dismissed, and blatantly obstructed by dereliction of the Wynwood Police Department, negligent mishandling by the medical examiner's office, and direct interference by Deputy Lieutenant Travis Crawford of the Gavin County Sheriff's Office, who possessed a clear conflict of interest via his prior relationship. Joining us tonight is the son, Matt Horton, to discuss the case, and Shannon Kyle, family spokesperson. We welcome you both to CrimeWire.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, I mean, it's our pleasure. I shouldn't say pleasure. We hate these cases, but we need to get them out in the public. And, you know, I'm going to kind of throw it open to you two guys, because in reading all this stuff, let me say this. If this stuff is true, which I just read pages and pages of material on this case, from the medical examiner to crime scene photos to things missing to things that were not done right, all in all, it's absolutely amazing. And, you know, I have a tendency to believe that all this stuff I read is true because you guys have gone through a lot of work. You guys have done a lot on this case. Why don't you, because we want to highlight as many things as possible, I want you guys to explain a little bit, whoever wants to start, exactly what has gone on in this case and what you're pointing at, okay?
Okay. Matt, if you don't mind, slip in real quick and just I want to make it clear that where we're from Garvin County, Oklahoma. The town we live in is Wynnewood, which is right next door to Elmore City, where Shanda Turner's from, which is right adjacent to Maysville, Oklahoma, where Sheila DeVinny's from. And I'd like to give a shout-out to those families who are listening, the Turner family, Joe, Donna, Linda, and Cully, and the DeVinny family, David and Susan. They're standing by waiting. All of us together are trying to get this thing solved here in our county that's just fraught with corruption and problems all the way up to Oklahoma City, the capital. We're just mired in it, and we're trying to do our best to get through it all. So I hope they're listening. I hope they're happy we've gotten this far today. Matt Horton's father was a longtime ag teacher in Wynnewood. He was a teacher there for, I believe, 24 years, 25 total in his career. He retired there. He was such a pillar of the community that they named an ag building after him. It has his name, huge letters on the top, and he was a salt-to-the-earth kind of fella, well-known throughout all of southern Oklahoma with his agricultural connections. Everybody knew him, and the particular circumstances of his death came as a shock to just about everybody because suddenly he's dead, and it just sort of just swept away, lockstep, done, and it just didn't seem to fit.
Let me ask you, how soon after this crime was committed? Was it days, weeks, where you and the family start feeling that was something really wrong here?
I'll let Matt handle that one. He can tell you exactly
Matt.
You start thinking it.
Well, the night it happened, we had immediate suspicions. My twin brother Pat, we drove down to Wynnewood. That's where our parents live, where our father was. And we immediately approached law enforcement. You know, asked them to leave no stone unturned. And basically this was the fact that our father had talked to us days prior of a scenario in where he would have someone carry out shooting him. If a certain individual was suicidal, he was going to hand this person a gun and have him shoot him. And so that's why we immediately, when we arrived on the scene, we asked that everything be investigated. We also asked that Travis Crawford not be involved in any way.
Why not Travis Crawford?
Because he's a personal friend of the suspect.
Okay.
The person who was in the house. We were assured by Scott Martin that he was not there at all and not involved. And in fact, he was.
Okay. What happened next?
Well, we asked if they had done a nitrate test. They decided not to do a nitrate test on the theory that the gun used would not produce enough nitrates to show up on any test, and also if it came out inconclusive, it could let an individual off, where they can never be prosecuted. And of course, after the fact, we also found out not only that Travis Crawford was involved, actually took the deposition from the suspect in his car, in his squad car. We also found out they took no fingerprinting. They took no evidence of any kind. In fact, the shotgun, we questioned which barrel of the shotgun fired later on. Apparently, the medical examiner's batteries ran out on his camera, so he was unable to take pictures of the shells in the gun or being removed after their removal.
Mm-hmm.
But they did show up from the medical examiner half a year later. By the person who would have been implicated, you know, for dereliction of duty in the first place. So our biggest frustration was Phil, too. After talking with the DA and we went through a grand jury and all of that, that the fact that the Wynnewood Police Department did not take fingerprints, did not do nitrate tests, did not secure evidence, that it was impossible and it was forever destroyed. And the DA actually apologized to us for this.
Let me tell our listeners that, you know, being an ex-cop myself and being a PI for 22 years doing many murder cases and cases of this nature, there is so much on this case that was not done, was done wrong, and things of that nature, that this is definitely going to be another show on top of this show. That's for darn sure, because we can't cover it all. One thing that jumps out to me, guys, is this, I don't know if you brought it up or not, the living person in the house who was under the influence of intoxicants, and why did he not give a statement? What was the problem with this guy, the only living person in the house?
I'll paint the whole scenario for you in living detail. Mr. Horton was found deceased by his sister-in-law in the late evening. She was so shocked and appalled that she immediately ran. She didn't have the presence of mind to use her phone because she was so shocked. She drove 6 or 7 blocks to the police station and in a panic reported it. The two officers there immediately drove to the scene and entered the dwelling with guns drawn to clear it, where they found the only living person in the house trying to elude them through the house. And they found him at gunpoint, where he made a startled accusation of, quote, "There's no one shot here."
Okay.
And yet, which, you know, relatively startling, but he then went on to say, "I won't say a word to any of you until you call this sheriff's deputy here and the chief of police here before I'll cooperate." And then for some reason he was allowed to roam through the crime scene making cell phone calls. He wasn't made to give a statement. He wasn't made to write a statement. He wasn't fingerprinted. He wasn't tested for any DSW. He wasn't detained. He wasn't frisked. He even carried out a series of duffel bags from the scene, clear view of all the officers there. And
amazing. Absolutely amazing.
And Matt told the truth about this thing with the sheriff's deputy. You can't make this up. All of us went to high school together here in Wynnewood. The relationship.
But Shannon, do you think that because of everybody knowing each other, it's a small town, it's a small community that.
Well, there's that, but they have a relationship going back 20 years where they were involved in juvenile crimes together. They have a very dastardly relationship that isn't ethical, and painted this case with an ugly brush that, you know, has ruined it possibly forever.
And how are your lives, you know, Matt and Shannon? I mean, you're coming out against great difficulty of your own safety. I mean, do you fear for your lives?
At this point, I can't believe we've lived this long, to be quite honest.
Why do you say that?
We have, all of us together, collectively, there was Matt and his brother Pat, their mother Susie, the other petitioners, Raymond and Karen Baser from Winniewood, myself, a bunch of supporters, people who helped carry the petition, like Geraldine Lister, Charmaine Wallace. We went out there and we had to face the bear. We went against the system, and we suffered for it, and we're going to suffer for it. That's just the way it is.
Can I ask a question, Shannon, or Matt, either one? From my understanding, my reading of the documents, this living person, potential suspect who was in the house, you just said he wasn't restrained in any way. He was allowed to walk through, apparently, the house, which was a crime scene, and make phone calls and remove duffel bags of stuff from the...
Two duffel bags, yes, sir.
Two duffel bags of stuff from the house. And, I mean, that just, as Vito said, amazing. It's incomprehensible to me. Now, who was actually in charge of the crime scene? I know you had two agencies there. You had the sheriff's department plus
well,
the Winniewood PD.
Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, after the grand jury's conclusion was that no one was in charge of the crime scene. It was just sort of the sheriff's office and the local police together. And
so they were saying there was no lead officers on this, no lead investigators. Everybody was kind of
well. If the lead officer for Winniewood would have been Scott Martin.
Okay.
And for the sheriff's office, it would have been Travis Crawford.
But these are the people that the so-called living person in the house specifically wanted on the scene before he would cooperate at all?
No, he wanted Travis Crawford and Ken Moore, the police chief, on the scene, mostly because he does have relationships with both of those individuals.
Well, you're I don't know what Vito thinks or anybody else, but I fear that what you've talked about is probably true. I mean, that crime scene was probably so wrecked, destroyed, and worthless that you're right. Probably anything of evidentiary value that ever was there either was mishandled, if it was collected, may not have been collected, or was contaminated. So, God, it just seems like a real mess.
It
was a complete disaster. And the DA basically said, you know, the only thing that could happen is someone's mouth, basically, because the crime scene was destroyed.
Oh,
and
has anybody paid for the crime scene being destroyed?
Not yet,
in any kind of a way. What's the population of this town, if I could ask you?
Last census, about 2,300 or so.
2,300. Okay, so
yeah.
Everybody
knows everybody, and like I said, Mr. Horton, you know, we're not gonna do him a disservice by saying he was a perfect saint. He wasn't. He was a man in his 60s who had health problems,
mm-hmm.
and he had problems with depression based on his health and his relationship with some domestic problems that were going on in the house. He was like anybody else, but he was the cream of the crop in the place we live.
Do you think that maybe they're not looking at it, though, Shannon, that they're not looking at it because he was had some issues? He wasn't the most upstanding guy?
I think it lends to a certain stereotype of, we better close this book because it's kind of a shameful chapter that we don't really want to let out. It will paint our town in a bad light. We need to just stuff it down right now.
Yeah, I would also like to mention, this is Matt, after we talked with the police about, you know, doing nitrate tests, have you done this, and they assured us that no stone would be left unturned. Later, we were shown by accident, a photo of the crime scene, and the shotgun with my father's hand on the triggers, on the gun, upright in his chair to the side. Later, we saw other pictures where his hand was not on the gun. So it had been manipulated before we'd even gotten there. So if they hadn't done a nitrate test or fingerprints, it seemed to me it was too late at that point. They had to do whatever they could to just get rid of us.
So the evidence had to fit their scenario. Are you saying they tailored the evidence basically to fit?
Well, I think by the
time... Absolutely.
They were not expecting us to go there and raise concerns. They had already destroyed the crime scene where fingerprints and nitrates could not be done by posing the deceased, by moving the gun around, moving things around, trampling on the crime scene. At that point, what could they have done? The suspect had already left with a duffel bag at that point, at the moment we entered the house.
Wait, real quick. Somebody's got their computer on. They need to turn off the volume, please. I can hear it come back.
Okay. And so we talked for at least, a half an hour to 45 minutes about, please, do what needs to be done. Nitrate fingerprints, check the crime scene, treat it as a crime scene. And after the end of the conversation, basically they went over to our mother and said, this is pretty much a open and shut case. You don't need to have an autopsy. You don't want one, do you? And at that moment, she said no.
Hey, Matt, you said something at the beginning of the segment here I just want to ask you about. You said as soon as this crime occurred, you asked right away that a certain officer would not be involved or show up at the crime scene. Am I getting from you guys that you already knew things about this police department in advance of this case where you did not trust these people? I'm talking about the
yes.
department itself?
Yes,
absolutely.
Okay, so they already had a bad reputation as far as you guys thought, right?
Yes.
Well, my personal opinion was that I had heard stories from the suspect about his dealings with...
I don't
with
know if you can hear me there, but my name is Raymond Baser, and I'm one of the petitioners that these boys are talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Mr. Horton, 2 days prior to the death, confided in me that if this certain individual threatened to kill himself, that he would give him a gun and say, fine, kill me, then kill yourself. And the shotgun they're talking about is a short, it's what they call an old stage gun or a coach gun that they used for defense on the old stagecoach. It was actually for decoration. And by the crime scene, they found the shotgun plus another 4 shells sitting on the table. But anyway, I helped these boys walk the streets of Garvin County getting the petition. And that's, I can confirm that what Mr. Horton told me was true.
Thank you, sir, for calling in. The board is filled, so I'm going to have to only take the one question.
Hey, Susan, yeah. Why don't you put out the information for people that want to communicate with us as far as anything else they want to say or give us information? Because this case is not going to go away. We're going to be looking at this case a lot. So.
It isn't. So they can email us at crimewire@gmail.com. All information is confidential. And we do. We are loaded on the board tonight. And so we apologize, but we don't apologize for bringing this to the forefront.
Fellas, I have visitors. I have members of our illustrious police department watching me do my broadcast here. There's no way we can hit all the high points tonight, but we appreciate you having us back. But we'll tell you how it ended, is that we had to go at the direction of the DA's investigator, who said the only way to fix this is with a grand jury. We went to get a grand jury. By law in Oklahoma, a town our size needs 500 registered voter signatures, of which we got in about 10 days. And the local election board refused to count them, telling us we needed 3 times that. They needed 1,718. The judge then said, yeah, that's what you need. Threw ours out. We had to start over again. We brought them nearly 3,000 with the help of all our petitioner friends, and they still wouldn't count them. We had to go to the Supreme Court twice just to get our grand jury in place. And then we gave a good accounting of ourselves there at the grand jury with the same evidence that y'all have seen. And with the help of these other petitioner families and their insight, the Devinneys and the Turners, we got all three homicides before a grand jury at the same time. And when that happened, that Turner case was so damaging to the system that they shut the whole thing down. They steered the grand jury into the ground, and nobody got any justice. So all three cases are cold again because they don't want to hear the truth.
Okay. Denny, do you want to say any last words on this? Because I think
I just want to thank Matt and Shannon for bringing all these cases to our attention, and we still have the one more case we want to cover, the Devinney case, and we'll be getting to that. And as Susan and Vito have said, this story, the overall story based on these cases, is not going to go away, and something's got to be done. And about medical exam, there's issues in other locations too. It's not just Oklahoma. There's issues across the country with medical examiners and coroner's offices. So it's going to be a continuing, ongoing thing. And I really want to thank Matt and Shannon for bringing these stories to our attention. And hopefully they'll come back on future shows when we revisit this stuff.
Absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
I'd like to end on one note, guys. All these families together, we've been doing our best to stay huddled together for protection and assistance to each other, and we started calling ourselves the 11th commandment: thou shalt not get away with it.
And you know what I suggest you guys do? Not to get away with it, you need to videotape your dear ears, all of you, and express your concerns and send the Crime Wire folks a tape, all right?
Okay, we will do. I have a tattoo on mine, so
all right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
All right, Denny, go ahead.
Yes. The next case we want to discuss is a case out of Fort Drum in Watertown, New York, and it's a 2007 death of a soldier by the name of Patrick Rust. And Patrick was assigned to the 10th Mountain Division, and he had returned from deployment to Afghanistan in January of 2007. He went on a 30-day leave. When he returned to post to Fort Drum, shortly after that, on March 14th, he moved off base to share an apartment with another soldier from his unit. That was on the 14th of March. On the 15th, Patrick and his new roommate, went out after work. They went to a mall in Watertown. Patrick didn't have a driver's license or drive, so he rode with a roommate. They spent about an hour and a half or so at the mall. Patrick Russ bought some games for his Game Boy PSP. They had a bite to eat at a Wendy's in the food court there. And then the roommate wanted to go get a tan at a tanning salon. Patrick didn't want to. Patrick left. This was according to the timeline prepared by the military at about 7:50 p.m. A soldier who knew Patrick saw him walking down the street and gave him a ride the last couple of blocks to the apartment, but never saw him go in. The next sighting we have of Patrick was at approximately 9:30 p.m. when he entered a bar called Clueless on Arsenal Street in Watertown. He was there until approximately 1 a.m. He ran into an old schoolmate of his that he'd gone to school with. And at approximately 1 a.m., he was reportedly cut off by the bartenders because he had too much to drink. He wasn't evicted. He wasn't causing trouble. They just didn't want to serve him anymore. He left the tavern shortly after that. Cell phone records showed he placed two phone calls to the cell phone of his former classmate that he had spent the evening talking with. And that's the last time there was any contact from or Patrick was seen alive. And he was reported as missing, as AWOL. A missing persons report was filed on him. And both the military, CID, and local police tried to find him with no luck. 6 months to the day after he went missing, September 16th of 2007, a farmer was cutting hay in a field about 5 miles out of town when he came across human remains. And it turned out that they were the remains of Patrick Rust. The autopsy performed by the military was inconclusive, was undetermined as to the cause and manner of death. And the condition of the remains was such that no toxicology could be performed. Since that time, the military has closed its investigation, and the investigation was placed in the hands of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, which had jurisdiction from where the remains were found. And with us tonight to discuss the case is Patrick's mother, Judy Rust, and also from Citizens Against Homicide, Gene Cervantes. Judy and Gene, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you.
Thank you, Denny.
Judy, let me, did I cover that fairly accurately so far?
Yes, you did.
Okay, and let me ask you this. Since, what is the current status, if you know, of the investigation that the Jefferson County Sheriff is handling?
I have two. I have one paper that says it's still active, inactive, and then I have another one that says it's closed.
So
which
one?
I have two different statuses.
Which, and they're both from the Sheriff's Department?
Yes.
One says closed and one says inactive?
Yes.
Okay. Have you checked with anyone else other than the Sheriff's Department to try to ascertain exactly what the status is? Have you checked with the district attorney?
Mm-hmm. I checked with the district attorney. And she told me that it was inactive.
Okay. Now, am I to assume that if the case is inactive, even though it's inactive, as long as it's still carried as open, that means there's no release of information because it could compromise an investigation?
That's right. I can't get any kind of information. I've asked, and they just can't turn anything over.
Okay, and the Army did close their investigation, am I correct on that?
Back in June, yes.
Okay. Gene?
Yes?
Would you explain a little bit so people understand your involvement here? Would you explain just a little bit about Citizens Against Homicide and how you became acquainted with Judy?
Well, I became acquainted with Judy, I believe she was a referral from you, Denny, and we... we don't do investigations. We just kind of run interference and for families of murder victims. And I made some phone calls on her behalf, and I had no response. And I was just talking with Judy this morning or this afternoon, and I was just frustrated because we have basically been treated the same way, you know, lack of response. And it's not unusual, like you said, if the case is open, that they're not going to release certain information. But, you know, the common courtesy, professional courtesy to at least extend that explanation to us was on my expectation anyway. And I got nothing. It seems to me that the investigation was, for lack of better phrasing, bungled. They didn't interview a lot of people who should have been interviewed, interviewed a second time. There were some contradictory statements. And the roommate, for some reason or other, knew two and a half hours before formation on the day Patrick went missing that he wasn't going to show up for formation.
Yeah, in the Patrick, the roommate and a sergeant went and cleaned out the apartment that Patrick had lived in, even before they went to the police.
Isn't that odd, though, Denny and Vito, as law enforcement officers? Isn't that kind of odd to do that?
Yeah, it definitely is. But you know, Susan, what jumps out at me at this case is that's definitely an odd thing to do. But you know, here's a guy that just serving his country, coming back from Afghanistan. I could picture Judy, the mom, praying for him every day while he was away. Am I right, Judy? Hoping
yes,
for a safe return, hoping that nothing happens to him over there.
Right.
And so many times we see these stories that individual comes back from the war and something happens to him in their own hometown or the town next to it. And that's a tragedy. And not only that, being an ex-cop, a lot of cops across the country, in fact, a good amount, more than in any other type of work, are former formerly served in the service, okay, all different branches. You get a lot of Marines that join the police department, things like that. You would think, knowing what this kid had just come from, that there'd be even a little extra oomph in the investigation, okay? And not that there shouldn't be on all the cases, but, you know, especially something like this where a fellow soldier, because a lot of cops are ex-military, and that's just how it goes, you know? So, that, I mean, a couple of those things jump out at me, you know?
And Vito, in addition to the Afghanistan deployment, Patrick had previously been in Iraq, so he'd done both of the, you know, the hot spots there and survived those, survived
right.
the combat zones, and he comes back and gets, well, we don't know exactly because it's undetermined, but he dies under certainly mysterious circumstances, virtually in his hometown. Patrick was a native of northern New York, so that was more or less. No home turf for him, and
yeah,
make
the first
it through
7 months. On the first
pardon?
7 months before they even found him, Fort Drum automatically said he was AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew different because Patrick had plans for that weekend, and I knew he would have never missed those plans. He talked about it since the day he came back from Afghanistan.
But he would never have not communicated with you either.
Excuse me?
As his mother. He would not have not communicated with you.
Oh,
he would
yes,
have kept in
definitely.
Contact. That's right. Oh, he was happy to be home. He was happy to see you.
He was happy to be home. Like I said, we just brought him back on base that Sunday. And he was going to Syracuse with his father for the weekend to celebrate his father's birthday. And it was on March 17th. So they were going to Syracuse to those kind of places. And he was really looking forward to that. And he was supposed to, in fact, he talked to his father at 5:30 Thursday night and was supposed to call him Friday morning to see what time they were going to pick him up. And he never called them Friday morning.
You know, Vito, your comments on the military, ex-military often going into law enforcement is very well taken. And my only comment on that is, you know, they've taken a sworn oath in the military. They take a sworn oath as police officers to protect and serve, and they allow personal feelings to interfere with the investigation. And
what do you mean, Gene?
Well, Judy, you want to explain that, or do you want me to go ahead? You know, the comment that the lead detective made about his superior.
Why don't you say it, Gene? Go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah,
The lead investigator was upset that Judy called the chief to report that, hey, this guy isn't doing his job.
I was kept calling to get some kind of information, and we had information to give to them, and they never called me. So I just went to the head person.
Right.
And then the head person went to them, and he made a comment to me that he wasn't doing that. He wasn't going to be told that he wasn't doing his job again.
Yeah.
So, Judy, were you kept quiet in a way? Like, what are you doing made to feel like you were doing the wrong thing to ask about your son?
Yes, they do think that.
And is that why you're hesitant, too? I mean, he's been gone a while now, and you – coming on the show is wonderful, but to be intimidated by the process,
mm-hmm.
I think that's wrong, and I think that Vito and Denny, how often do we see that? And this is not all police officers, because police officers, as we've said before, are wonderful. They're not all like this, but this is a perfect example of intimidating a family, a grieving family member, a mother, to be quiet, to go sit in her place until we decide when we're going to tell her something. Would you not agree, Denny and Vito?
Well, you know what's
yep.
going on nowadays, you know, being away from the police department for many years, and I've said this before, but one of the biggest changes I've seen, and again, The vast majority of cases are handled properly. Most of them are solved. There's great police work going on. But let's say in my time there was 5% of cases. I'm just throwing out any kind of figure. 5% of cases that were bungled and not handled right and total messes like we talked about tonight. Okay? That figure is up to maybe 15% now, okay, which is a big jump because that is so many hundreds and hundreds across the country now, whereas maybe 85% are still, and again, these are just figures off the top of my head, 85% are handled properly, but if you have any kind of jump from 5% to 10 or 5% to 15, it's hundreds and hundreds more like this that we're hearing about. And I think it winds up being laziness. I think it winds up being people that just don't want to pursue any avenue. When I was in the detective bureau, my boss would say, go back out there before we close this case. Go check. Go interview all those 18 people again. Go back over here. Go do this. Go check some more things. See, I don't know so much if that goes on nowadays. I wonder.
It does, because in my active casebook, it's going on every day. And what I'm tired of hearing and seeing, and that's why this show is so important, is stop telling the victims' families that they don't matter. Stop telling them if you come on a show or if you speak to a reporter, you're going to compromise something. Well, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 years later, it doesn't matter anymore.
That's
They're not doing anything.
Too. Susan, that's a big difference, too, nowadays. The way victims and their victims' families are treated is much different from my era, much, much different. In many cases, they're not treated properly. They're treated with disrespect, and that has changed. That part has changed also tremendously over the years.
That's right. Why am I doing combat? Well, you know, we're helping people and doing combat, and because of victims' families, just like Judy, she's told to be quiet. And that is so important, isn't it, Judy?
Yes, it is. And another thing, a lot of these Fort Drum people, they're refusing to talk to the police. And they're getting lawyers so that they don't have to be talking to the police. And I was told once that Jack had told them not to talk to the police without a lawyer with them.
It's got to stop. Go ahead.
And, you know, this handful of officers or investigators around the United States, and like everybody has already said, it's just a very, very small percentage of officers who don't do a proper investigation. And you made some comments, Denny, but I want to add one other word. It's pride. Arrogance that these people – investigators don't follow through and don't do a proper investigation and don't turn around and say, you know what, I screwed up, I need help. There's nothing wrong with asking for help. And if there's any investigators out there listening, you know, you have a sworn obligation to do the best possible job you can to solve a crime.
Yeah, we were also told by one of the sergeants of Patrick's, he knew definitely that Patrick would not go AWOL, and a couple other people did. And when they went to the military police and CID, of course, they couldn't find him, so they said that he was AWOL. And he told me that the young guy that they had working on the CID shouldn't be doing that case because he didn't have enough knowledge to do something like that. He said he should take care of stuff on the base, but something big like that should have went to somebody that knew more.
Judy, do you think somebody knows something? Do you think somebody knows something, Judy, that hasn't come forward that are afraid to for some reason that you know, maybe if they knew how to reach you or knew how to reach somebody that wasn't in the military or law enforcement, you might have an answer?
I do think somebody knows, and just last year I went back on the TV and I said this has been the 2-year anniversary that Patrick's been missing, and if anybody on Fort Drum knows anything, you know, it's been 2 years. It's probably ready to speak out now. And if they would call, and we haven't heard from anybody. We even had a tip line, and we didn't get anything on that either.
Judy?
Yeah?
Go ahead, sorry.
I just wanted to go back to March 16th or 17th when Patrick – when were you actually informed that he was missing?
Okay, on March 19th. Somebody from Fort Drum had called me to ask me if I saw Patrick. And I didn't, but I assumed that he was in Syracuse with his father. That's
okay.
The last I knew. And then on March 20th, on that Tuesday, the Watertown police called and said that somebody from Fort Drum had gone down there, said that Patrick never showed up for his on base that Monday. So we went down to file a missing person report.
Okay, but
and,
he actually hadn't shown up on Friday,
Friday,
right?
Friday either. So they let the whole weekend go by.
And then Monday they
went to the Watertown police.
And the 20th was the first that you were officially informed that he was missing.
Right. Tuesday morning was the police called me, yes. But Fort Drum was looking for him Monday. But I really didn't know he was missing then. I just thought he was still Syracuse and then get back over the weekend. I didn't know. But when they found him on the 16th, about 5:30 Sunday, I never heard anything. And about 9:20 that Sunday night, the Watertown Daily Times called me and asking questions about the findings. And I had never knew yet that they found him. So I called the detective that was working on it, and he said, yes, they did. And the St. Lawrence State Police was supposed to come over and tell me, since we are in St. Lawrence County, and that was Jefferson County. And they were supposed to stop over to tell me. And I stayed up all night, of course. I wouldn't go to bed anyways. But and nobody ever showed up to my house to tell me.
And I just wanted to mention that Peter Hyatt, who's a statement analyst and one of our CrimeWire consultants, was going to join us tonight, but due to a scheduling conflict, he couldn't make it. But Peter Hyatt has reviewed some of the sworn statements from, well, from Patrick's roommate and Patrick's supervising sergeant that were given to CID investigators back in 2007. And Peter's review of those documents, he believes, show strong signs of deception that these two individuals were withholding information and being less than honest when they gave their statements. Do you know if the military at all would plan to re-interview these guys or anything? Are you pretty sure that when they said their case is closed, I mean, that they're all done with them?
I'm trying to get in contact with them again to see if we can go and talk, you know, get it out again.
Judy, have the roommates ever looked in your eye? Have you ever got a sense as a mother that something was wrong?
I never saw the roommate.
So you never met him?
I never met him. Nope, I tried to call him. I don't know how many times I've tried to
call him. Isn't that odd? Wait, isn't that odd? Isn't that odd?
Yeah,
something's wrong there. It stinks.
He never got back to me. I tried to call him. Well, finally, he did pick up his phone once when I called him. And I asked him about, you know, the mall and different things. He just answered my questions, you know. I left. I went panning, and he was going home, and that was the last time he saw him.
So in many cases,
I was asking him about what he bought at the mall. Well, he told me that they weren't together, so he wasn't exactly what he bought. But then in another statement, they were at the mall together.
Oh, that smells of high heaven. You always, when you're close to somebody, you want to make the person to the family, don't you? Have a connection, Gene?
Well, not only that, Susan, there's a comment that he made about a great amount of money when asked, where do you think Patrick is? Do you want to elaborate on that? Judy?
Yes, on the statements that I have from Fort Drum when they were interviewing people, they asked him, where do you think Patrick is? And his answer was, which nobody thinks this is an odd answer, his answer was, if I had $27,000 in the bank, I would be over to Canada if I wasn't already dead. And nobody thinks that answer, anything's wrong with that answer.
I go figure.
It's puzzling, I think, to say the least. Judy, based on your contact with the military meetings or discussions you've had with them, do you know if they polygraphed anyone? Was anybody administered polygraphs? Because Peter Hyatt's opinion is that these two individuals, the sergeant and the roommate, that neither of them would have passed a polygraph test. Do you know if any polygraphs were done?
I don't think they were, and I asked the detectives, and they didn't. They weren't sure if there was either.
Not sure.
You think
that would be a fairly prominent thing in a case file. If there, the other thing I wanted to ask is, I've been, of course, looking over some of this stuff and kind of gotten into this myself, and I've been trying to figure out why Patrick went to this particular bar on that particular night where he'd never been known to be before. So now going to a strange bar, or a different bar, is there's certainly nothing wrong with that. But when it happens to be the same night that you go missing, you know, you have to wonder if there's a connection.
And first night off base, the second night
and
off
the first,
base.
Yeah, the second night that he
the
moved off
night.
Base.
Mm-hmm.
So my my thought was, do you know if anyone, if well, probably the military or civilian, checked the phone records of the roommate to see if there was any communication between him and Patrick that night, or maybe or him and anybody. I'm just wondering, you know, if the roommate was checked out in more detail as far as who he communicated with that night, because the way I read the information was, he basically had no alibi. In other words, he said he returned to the apartment from the tanning salon at about 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
He fell
but Denny, but Denny, wouldn't that say though to that because they automatically said he was AWOL that they were not going to even check phone records?
Well, that's my concern, but, you know, there was enough suspicious stuff here. For example, the sergeant who went to the, who did the inventory of his equipment with the roommate and then went to the police department after they removed the stuff, both of them made in their sworn statements and their statement to the police that this was highly suspicious circumstances because Patrick would never go AWOL. In fact, he had recently reenlisted and was going to be transferred to Fort Lewis, Washington, and was looking forward to the transfer and was excited about it. So,
he did call me Tuesday night about that, and he was really excited about it.
Was there some of money maybe that he was going to get for the reenlistment that he had already gotten? Is that possible?
He was going to get one. I don't know if he already got it or not, but there was a sum.
That's important right there, guys. If this guy had debt to the other guy, the roommate, maybe there was something that he was able to do or get in the mail and cash something or do something that nobody knew about because nobody was really looking at him at that time. Does that seem like that might be possible?
Yeah, it definitely does. And Judy, did I hear you right before? You never actually met the roommate in person?
No, I never have.
Okay, that's very odd, like we started off this conversation a little while ago talking about, because any case I'm familiar with or things of that nature, the first thing a roommate is going to want to do is say, Judy, hi, you don't know me that well. My name is so-and-so. I was your son's roommate. I feel bad. What can I do?
Mm-hmm.
And stay in communication with the mother. That's,
yeah,
that's
he
the
did
normal
with the father.
Thing. Pardon
yeah,
me?
I guess he has talked to his father.
Okay, but
he
but
talked
still.
More to the father, but never to me.
Yeah, but like was said a little while ago, no statement, no
mm-hmm.
there's no polygraph,
no.
You know, no communication with you, the mom,
right.
You know, who's going through all this. I mean, it's very, very definitely unusual. But, you know, let me say this about our show here, and I was thinking while I was just listening to everybody, you know, the TV shows that I get involved with a lot of times and I go on and talk, what happens? They get a hold of what's called a high-profile case, okay? And they're all over the country, be it Peterson or down in Florida, whatever may be going on. And all the shows and all the networks stay on these two or three cases all the time. They get the label high-profile. But guess what? High-profile cases, any family like yourself that's gone through this, this is a high-profile case for each family that goes through this. And what we do that's different from any show that I know of is we get a lot of times and go into the cases that wouldn't be called by the media high-profile, and we make them high-profile. We hate to keep using that term, because but every case out there where there's a death and a son dies, a daughter disappears, is high profile for that family. And we need to always understand that. And one thing I got to say about Denny, Denny has sunk his teeth into this story from the beginning. He called me on a daily basis to give me updates and different things like that. So I can tell you that, you know, we're really looking into this, Judy. I just want to assure you of that, because this is high profile for your family, okay?
Yes, I want to thank you guys, too. If it wasn't for you guys, I would still be, I don't know where, waiting,
well,
sitting.
We're hoping, you know, and I'm not trying to speak for you, Judy. I'm just saying that I would think that if you can find out what actually happened to Pat, whatever that might be, and at this point we can speculate, but nobody knows for sure.
Right.
But if you could get credible evidence, credible proof of what happened to him,
mm-hmm.
that would have to at least bring you some closure, no matter what that truth is, at least you could to know. I mean,
definitely.
this is what went down, this is how it happened,
mm-hmm.
whatever. But
I mean, I have
not
a suggestion
knowing.
Too, the bank records. I think that if somebody sees, and if somebody can try to trace a check, something, from the military at the time of his death, to, you know, something that he was going to be receiving, because the roommate, again, would have access, he'd have the mailbox, maybe something was cashed, and it just, in the process of all this, no one, you know, got the wiser because there was so much chaos going. Or old phone records. Try to call the phone cell company of your son's carrier and see if you can perhaps get that to see, because you are your son's best
friend. I tried that. It had to go through the police. The police had to do that. I couldn't do it.
Let me advise you of something, which I'll just throw out here. I have seen cell phone records of Patrick. The roommate was interviewed a second time. He was interviewed right after Patrick was reported AWOL, reported missing, and then again after Patrick's remains were found. For the second interview, he had been deployed to Korea, so the CID people in Korea did the interview. And he was asked in that sworn statement, he said he woke up at 1 in the morning and noticed Patrick wasn't in the apartment. And he was asked why he got up at 1 o'clock in the morning, if there was, you know, what woke him up. He said, I always get up in the middle of the night to check my email. Well, that, you know, I guess whatever you think of that statement, that's what he said. Then he said he awoke again about 5 a.m., and Patrick, he got up, and Patrick still wasn't there. The interviewer, the CID interviewer, said, did you attempt to contact Patrick? So this would have meant that he would have tried Patrick's cell phone at approximately 5 a.m. He said, yes, I did. Then the interviewer said, what did you do next? He said, then I immediately sent a text message to the supervising sergeant advising him that Patrick would not be at formation, which was at 7:30. I've examined the phone records, and there was no incoming call to Patrick's phone or outgoing. There was no action on Patrick's phone whatsoever from about 1:36 a.m. until 6:22 a.m. So the roomie's statement that he attempted to contact Patrick at around 5 o'clock, unless he had some alternate phone number or something, but as far as Patrick's cell phone and the number that everyone used for Patrick, no such call came in at 5 a.m. or the vicinity of 5 a.m. And, of course, you can make of that what you will, but that would seem to be contradictory to what the sworn statement said.
And that's what I was speaking to, Denny, earlier when I said there's a lot of contradictory statements and there was a significant amount of lack of follow-up, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, you know, we're running out of time very quickly here. Just before we get shut down, Judy, you're not giving up on this, am I correct? You still want to get to the bottom of what happened to your son?
Oh, yes, definitely. If I knew how to do it, I've sat here for the last year. I didn't know where to go anymore, you know, or what to do.
We're going to be there with you as much as we can. And, Gene, will you continue to try to assist Judy?
Absolutely. In fact, Judy, why don't you call me tomorrow?
You know, it looks like we might have Peter Hyde on real quick. Peter, you want to weigh in real quick? We got a minute left. Area code 281? It's not Peter Hyde. Do you have a question? Okay, I guess they don't. I'm sorry.
Hey, Susan. Susan, yeah. I'm glad we took the extra time on this case tonight, because this is a man that went to serve his country while we could all go about our business each day, okay? While we could walk down Main Street USA, go for pizza, do all the fun things in life while this guy goes to Iraq and Afghanistan. So I'm very happy that we put the extra time in tonight.
I think that we all are, and if people have any information, and they, again, it stays confidential. So if you're listening, if you know something, if, you know, even in casual passing, you've dated somebody that might have said something, that's important. Our email is thecrimewire@gmail.com. It's very important. Again, the information stays with us. It doesn't go anywhere else, and we pass it on to law enforcement. And our prayers go with you, Judy, to hopefully resolve this case.
All right, and thank you, everybody.
Susan.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks, Jean.
Our website is citizensagainsthomicide.org.
Okay, thank you so much. Well, we're out of time. Thank you, the CrimeWire team, our research producer, Kim Colton, and public team relations manager, imaginepublicity.com. Our next show is next week. Tune in while we dissect, analyze cases that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Good night.
You know?
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Okay.
And
bye-bye.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there's nowhere else to turn. Visit our CrimeWire site at www.crimewiresite.com.
Great show, guys. All right.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.